It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The midterm election is less than a month away. As part of our ongoing series of candidate interviews, today we'll hear from Patrick Baird, the Libertarian candidate for Lieutenant Governor. He's a Navy veteran and an author, according to his campaign website, and he currently works as a patient advocate. He faces Green Party candidate Tiffany Anderson, Democrat Mandela Barnes, Republican incumbent Rebecca Clefish, and Independent Will Loesch. Patrick Baird, welcome to the Morning Show.
Thank you, John.
First of all, why are you running for a lieutenant governor?
Well, I'm running for lieutenant governor. My running partner, Phil Anderson, who's running for governor, asked me to run with him. I was happy to say yes. Phil and I share the same ideals in terms of our principles of limited government and more freedom for individuals and communities. So it was a perfect match, and I'm happy to have been on the road for the last over more than the last year or so with Phil spreading those views.
You're running against four other people in the midterms, Green Party candidate Tiffany Anderson, Democrat Mandela Barnes, Republican incumbent Rebecca Clefish, and Independent Will Loesch. What sets you apart from your opponents?
What sets Phil and I apart from any of the other parties or candidates that are running is that we're the only candidates that are advocating sincerely and seriously for limited government and more individual freedom. The Republicans like to pay lip service to those principles, but in practice, they tend to do just the opposite. We're very serious about reducing the size and scope of the power in Madison, returning more local control to local communities, and making sure that individuals have more personal freedom in their lives.
How does your experience prepare you to be lieutenant governor?
Well, I've been working in the healthcare area for about 15 years now. I've currently working as a patient advocate. I'm on the front lines of the health insurance industry every day, fighting on behalf of patients to get coverage for their services and to get their claims paid. So I'm very, as far as that issue goes, I'm very familiar with it, and that's one of the primary issues that's being discussed here in the campaign this year. In addition to that, I've got years of experience working in marketing and communications, so I certainly could help, if nothing else, I could help Phil, if elected, to get that message out there to the public.
What do you see as Wisconsin's biggest challenge right now?
Well, from our perspective, the biggest challenge is the economy, that we believe that a economy that's based on crony capitalism, which is what you have now with the Republicans in charge, exemplified by the Foxconn deal, where corporations get special tax breaks, special deals, outright handouts from the government, and in many cases, companies that don't really need the help, which is certainly the case, I believe, with Kimberly-Clark. That's an economy that is not sustainable and is not going to grow in an organic way. So what we're in favor of, we're advocating the elimination of the state income tax. Obviously, that benefits individuals, but we also believe that would benefit the economy by allowing those businesses that file through personal income tax, small businesses in particular, to get a tax break that they could plow back into their businesses to help the economy. We need to have an economy that's based on actual free market rather than on whoever is politically connected or maybe giving campaign donations to those in power in Madison.
So how would you actually bring about that kind of change?
Well, obviously, we'd have to work with the legislature. Anything that we propose, anything that we do, I wouldn't say anything. There's a few things the governor has power to do on his own, but most things, we would have to work with whoever's in charge of the legislature. And that's one of the advantages of being a third party, is that we're not going to go to Madison having to worry about protecting our legislative majority or trying to get a legislative majority. I mean, we'd love to have one someday, but we're a ways away from that currently. So Phil would be able to work with both sides. He'd be able to find common ground with Democrats on some issues. He'd be able to find common grounds with Republicans on other issues. And he'd be able to broker compromise that would actually work for the people of Wisconsin rather than the current system, which is all about two parties going at each other with hammer and tongs, in between the elections trying to gain advantage. So I think we would work as an honest broker, and we would find ways to advance our agenda through finding common grounds with the two parties.
Patrick Baird is a Libertarian candidate for Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin. We're talking to all of the Lieutenant Governor candidates on Wisconsin Public Radio, as well as other people running for office in the state. Patrick, you and fellow Libertarian Philip Anderson are running for Lieutenant Governor and Governor, respectively. And you just mentioned that if elected, you both say you'll eliminate the state income tax. That helps fund our public schools, Medicaid, among other line items. If we eliminate this tax, where do you make up for the funding that would no longer be available?
Well, there's seven other states that don't have an income tax. And those states, they have universities, they have public schools, they have services through the government. They just fund them differently. We're really promoting local control in this election. That's one of our biggest issues. We believe that the discussions and the debate over spending priorities, taxation, those should all be held wherever possible on the local level. Getting rid of the income tax would allow that debate to happen in your own community, where you could, with your neighbors, debate and decide what priorities were important to you in your community, rather than having Madison take that money, take a cut, take some of it and spend it on whatever they want to spend it on, give a portion of it back to you. But when they give a portion of it back to you, they attach all kinds of strings that limit local control and limit what you can do in your own schools and in your own community. So we think it's a very inefficient system to rely on income tax to fund our schools and other services. Obviously, there's some things that the state will still need to do, and we can find innovative ways to pay for those services. But as I said before, anything that we do is going to have to be done through the legislature. So eliminating the income tax is not something that Phil is going to be able to wave a magic wand and make it happen. It's something that we'd have to work with the legislature to work towards. Obviously we'd have to identify areas of savings in government, but there'd also be a shift from the state down to the local level in terms of taxation.
Okay, so the role of lieutenant governor doesn't currently have a lot of authority under Wisconsin's constitution. How would you use the role to make a measurable difference in Wisconsin?
Well, Phil and I have talked about that, and Phil views me as a partner in governing. And I would take whatever role Phil needed me to take, whether it was being an advocate for certain issues, whether it was working directly with members of the legislature as a go-between. Whatever Phil needed me to do, that's what I would do. I would be a lot more actively involved than, let's say, some previous lieutenant governors might have been. For instance, I won't point any fingers, but I know that there's at least one recent lieutenant governor who was not the first choice of her governor candidate. That's not the case with Phil and I. Phil and I are good friends, and he was the guy that he wanted me to run with him. So we'll be good partners in any governing relationship.
I want to go back to the tax question again, because this is a really big deal. A lot of the other states that don't have a state income tax have some sort of natural resource tax or extraction tax, may have some resources like natural gas or oil or something like that that helps to fund their state government. Wisconsin doesn't really have any of that. So what other sources of revenue are there? You talk about innovative ways to pay for things. Could you name one?
Well, I'm going to be honest with you, and I'm going to be honest with your listeners. Those states also depend more heavily on property taxes and sales taxes. So there would be a shift from the income tax to sales taxes and property taxes. But as I said, the reason that we favor that is that it's much easier to have a debate about spending priorities at your local level than it is to try to influence Madison to reduce spending. So that's the main reason we want to do that. Now, there are certainly fees and other designated taxes like the gas tax. I mean, we like the gas tax because it's designated for one purpose, and it works pretty well in funding our roads. So, you know, we'd look at those sorts of things. We'd look and see what some of the other states do have revenue through gas or other natural resources. But we look at all the other things that they do, and we try to follow their lead to see what might work for Wisconsin.
There's a lot of talk these days about the role of money in our elections and in politics in general. What do you think about the role of money in elections?
We've been very strong coming out against crony capitalism. Libertarians are often accused of, if the libertarians were in charge, the corporations would run wild. That's absolutely not true at all. That's corporatism. That's the system we have now, where corporations and special interests go to Washington, they go to Madison, they use their money and their power to influence politicians to do their bidding and to craft legislation and regulations that favor them. They get tax breaks. They get handouts from the government. We are 100% against that. We've been very vocal coming out against the Foxconn deal. We like to see an economy that's based on merit, where quality products, quality services, price, all of those are the things that determine who wins in the marketplace, not how connected you are. So if you want to get all that dirty money out of politics, if you're sick of all those TV ads that you have to put up with every 2 years, get the power out of Madison and Washington. Shift it down to your local level. That's how you're going to do that.
Patrick Baird, thank you for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me, John.
Patrick Baird is a Libertarian candidate for Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. In addition to M or F, a third gender option on certain documents is now available to more Americans. Minnesota recently added an X gender option for driver's licenses, and New York City will now allow it on birth certificates. Other states have previously made similar changes. A sociologist joins us to explain the significance of having the third gender option on these documents, as well as who might want to choose the X category. What do you think about adding a third gender option to birth certificates and driver's licenses? Would you like to see Wisconsin follow suit? And are we talking to you here? Is this a category you would choose for yourself? Is inclusivity something worth considering when it comes to these documents, or do you think it creates more problems than it's worth? And maybe you just have questions about the whole thing. 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, tweet us at WPR Mornings. Barbara Risman is a distinguished professor of sociology at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Her most recent book is Where the Millennials Will Take Us, A New Generation Wrestles with the Gender Structure. Barbara, welcome to The Morning Show.
Pleased to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, what do you see as the significance of adding this third option or X option on birth certificates and driver's licenses?
I think it shows us how deeply felt identities are in today's world, particularly among young people, that the feeling of being constrained to identify in a way that doesn't feel authentic has become intolerable. And so the argument and the drive for this new category comes from that felt need of not wanting to be inauthentic, not wanting to be boxed in to a category that doesn't feel it represents who you are.
Do you think this is a positive move?
I do think it's a very positive move, but I think it's only the first move in a complicated problem, to deal with a very complicated problem. I think that the public recognition in the law that not everyone identifies as either a woman or a man or is even biologically male or female is very important. But I also think that simply a one simple size fits all third category is only the first step of a conversation and probably isn't going to be the final solution to the complications around both sex and gender, because it conflates the two.
So give us a sense of who might opt for this X option.
Okay, so that's part of why this is only the beginning of a solution and not, I don't think, the long-term one, and that is the X option, that the variety of people and reasons people might use an X option lumps all different kinds of issues. So the first kind of person who might want to use an X option is someone who's now called intersex. That is a person who literally was born with, in a, you know, we like to think that the biological sex, male or female, what you're labeled when you're born is always clear, but in fact it's not always clear. There are people who are born with a hormonal status that would be defined as female and genital structures that are appear to be male and vice versa. And so for those intersex babies, an X category can work either for their whole lives or until they, you know, we won't really know until who they come to be until they're older and can make that choice themselves. So in states or cities where parents can use that category for intersex children, I think that's very positive because up until now, those children were often really unnecessarily submitted to all sorts of operations to force them into one category or the other. And the adults who have an intersex social movement now are showing very clearly that that has very negative consequences. It often includes loss of any kind of feeling in one genital region, which, you know, not many of us would want to force upon a child. So I think that that's a category that it makes perfect sense for. It also makes sense for people, mostly young people, use this new language of being non-binary and not feeling as if they are woman or man. And so a category X feels right to that some of them. That's a harder, that's an interesting category, and why I think that this is the beginning and not the end solution is for these people, it's not clear that sex and gender are necessarily the same synonyms, and that is this X about one's sex or is it about one's gender? For intersex people, particularly babies, it's really about sex. For non-binary people, it's really about gender. Some non-binary people will say they also have no sex, but in my next book that I'm writing, I'm interviewing non-binary people, and I find all different answers. Some believe that they are male or female, their gender is just non-binary, and others also reject the sex category. So some of those people will want category X, but others will not. And so though all of those different kinds of people are, in some senses, dumped together in one category.
How much, from what you've seen, is there a lot of demand for this third option?
That's a great question. We have no research on this yet. There's been absolutely no, and for good reason, it's very hard to do representative sampling and get a big enough N, you know, enough people to know. But we really have no idea how popular this option is going to be. I think in every case when the laws are changed, they're changed based on arguments from social movements. But we're going to have to wait and see how popular an option it actually is. In my research, I find that while some transgender respondents in my book might choose a category X, others are perfectly happy to choose male or female. They just want to be free to choose which of those categories reflects who they are.
So we talked about Minnesota and driver's licenses as well as New York City and birth certificates. Where else have we seen changes made?
We've actually seen changes made or being made on the entire West Coast. Washington State, Oregon, and California. We've also seen changes made in other countries. And so this is clearly, I think this is a trend of the future. I don't think we'll know until we see the demand for it and the kinds of people with what kinds of identities who use it. The laws have gone into effect in very different ways. In many state laws, only adults who, looking back, can change their birth certificates.
Okay.
In New York City, they're allowing parents to use this on babies' birth certificates. And those are two very different ways.
We'll continue our discussion in just a moment. Barbara Risman is a distinguished professor of sociology at the University of Chicago. What do you think about adding a third gender option to birth certificates or driver's licenses? 800-642-1234. It's the Ideas Network and The Morning Show on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. In addition to M or F, a third gender option on certain documents is now available to more Americans. Minnesota recently added an X gender option for driver's licenses, and New York City will now allow it on birth certificates. Other states have previously made similar changes. What do you think about adding a third gender option to birth certificates and driver's licenses? Would you like to see Wisconsin do that? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Barbara Risman is Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and she joins us for this conversation. Barbara, I think a lot of us might be using words like sex and gender interchangeably. Based on what you said earlier, though, is that something you see as a mistake and something we should change about the way we talk about these issues?
I absolutely think that that's a mistake. I think it's a really interesting question how we got to this point where I totally agree with sex and gender seems to be used if they were synonyms. But I think it's much more appropriate to very careful in our language and think about sex as having something to do.
And I think we just lost our guest. We'll get her back in just a moment. Barbara Risman is Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the University of Illinois, Chicago. What do you think about adding a third gender option to birth certificates and driver's licenses? Would you like to see Wisconsin follow suit? And are we talking to you here? Is this a category that you would choose for yourself? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas at WPR.org, or you can always tweet us. Our handle is at WPR Mornings. Again, 800-642-1234, and we're starting to get a bunch of calls here. So let's go to the phones, and we'll start with John, who joins us from Milwaukee. John, welcome to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for this important topic. I wanted to share that I have my youngest child identifies as transgender queer and uses the pronouns they, them, and theirs. And they would use this designation in a heartbeat. Every time they have to go get a driver's license or fill anything out, they have to pick something that they are not, and so they misgender themselves even. And so I think a movement to this would be good. In addition, they just got married last month, and they use the designation mix instead of Mr. or Mrs. So I think there's a lot of growth and a lot of movement in this area of gender identity that we're going to be seeing soon.
John, thank you. Thank you for that call. Barbara Risman?
Hi. I'm back again.
Yeah. Did you hear what John, our caller, just had to say about...
Absolutely.
Okay. Go ahead.
I think that John's child is a perfect example of someone for whom this X category should be quite helpful, because a non-binary person, a transgender queer person, will often feel as if they're lying every time they fill out a form that asks them for their sex. I want to get back to the point you asked me earlier when I was cut off, and that is, I do think in my research that people who identify as non-binary, some of whom would use this, some of whom do not identify as non-binary for their sex, but only for their gender. And so that in my research, what I find is that it's very complicated. Some people reject the categories of their sex and their gender. Others are comfortable saying, yes, I'm male or female, but I'm genderqueer. I don't fit the ways that we expect in our society women or men to act. And so I don't want to be called a woman or a man. I am not. I'm non-binary. But I am comfortable with my reproductive sex category. And so that these are really different. The words really do have different meaning to different people. And I think that we don't have the final solution for how we should go forward, but we need to have the conversation, because people use the words differently, and for language to help us communicate, we need to be clear we're all using the words with the same definition.
Okay, let's take another call. This time we'll go to Bloomer, and Mark is joining us from there. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. I'm a straight man. I'm married. I got it. It doesn't affect me. If it makes somebody else feel emboldened or feel more whole to have other options, go for it. The only people who could be opposed to this are the same people who were opposed to gay marriage. Gay marriage isn't a threat to my marriage. Cheating straight men are a threat to my marriage.
Okay, Mark, thanks for the call. Barbara Rissman, now how common would Mark's sentiment be?
I think that Mark's sentiment would be very common among people who hold liberal attitudes. I agree with Mark's statement for sure, that if this is a positive move forward for people who feel that the society devalues them because we do not let them identify in a way that feels authentic, that's a great thing. I do think we're living in very volatile political times and very divisive political times, and I don't think that his opinion necessarily reflects all of America at the moment. I think this is one issue on which we are split as much as we are split on the Me Too movement and other political gender issues.
And clearly there are multiple points of view on this issue. In the case of Minnesota, one state senator wondered if the driver's license change would hamper law enforcement's ability to properly identify suspects or hinder the investigative process. We had Jerry from Waukesha who called in to say it's ridiculous that Minnesota passed this. Must be the liberals who are pushing for it. Pam called in to say, I'm a farmer, and looking around the farm, I only see two genders in animals. Biologically, there are two genders in humans. I think adding a third option is foolish. So not everybody is on the same page here, as you pointed out, Barb.
Right. I would like to point out that farmer who only sees two categories is seeing two sexes. That farmer has we don't have the same kind of gender in animals that don't have consciousness, because gender identities have to do with ability to have self-reflective identities. And that is quite different from farm animals. And so that, I think, is a great illustration of why we have to be careful when we talk about these issues to see whether or not we're asking for sex or gender. I will get on a plane later today to go to Australia to do some speaking gigs, and I will be asked to check my gender, and then it will be male, female. I don't really think the TSA cares whether I'm very feminine or masculine, which is really about my gender. What they really care about is my sex, so that for the when I go through security, they know, you know, whether or not I'm hiding a gun in some part of my body. And so I think I resent every time I'm asked my gender, because like everyone else, my gender is complicated. I'm not particular. I'm definitely female and I'm a woman, but I'm not very feminine. I pride myself on being quite efficacious and aggressive in some situations.
All right, Barb, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
It's been a pleasure being here. Thank you for having me.
Barbara Risman is Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Her most recent book, Where the Millennials Will Take Us, A New Generation Wrestles with Gender Structure. Coming up next, Saudi Arabia faces increased international backlash after a journalist disappeared in Istanbul earlier this month. He was last seen entering the Saudi consulate there. We'll get the latest after news from NPR and WPR. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
There are many things to enjoy in Wisconsin in every season of the year. Wisconsin Public Radio is here 365 days a year to serve you with informative, thought-provoking programs. Thank you to WPR members whose support makes it all possible.
If you're a sustaining member, your reliable monthly donations help keep our focus on programming and less on fundraising. If you're not a sustainer yet, visit WPR.org and become one right now. Your secure, ongoing gift of $5 or $10 a month will feel great, and it'll keep Wisconsin Public Radio strong for you and your community.
Stay connected with the WPR app on Google Play and the iTunes App Store. It makes it easy to listen to WPR live and read recent news stories. You can also hear WPR programs on demand. WPR is everywhere.
It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Saudi Arabia faces increasing international backlash after the disappearance of a journalist in Istanbul earlier this month who was last seen entering the Saudi consulate there. Investigators from Turkey believe Jamal Khashoggi was killed at the hands of the Saudi regime, a claim that's being denied by the Saudi king. Now President Trump is weighing in and is sending Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to meet with the king. A reporter brings us up to speed on the unfolding situation, the American response, and what's at stake here. Michael Hirsch is a senior correspondent at Foreign Policy. Michael, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
At the core of all this is journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who went missing earlier this month after a visit to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. What do we know about this disappearance?
Well, it's been something of a mystery in the 2 weeks since he disappeared, but just yesterday there were some developments. CNN first reported, and other news outlets joined in, that the Saudis are now considering acknowledging that Khashoggi died during an interrogation at the consulate in Istanbul. Previously, they had simply said that he had left, and they didn't know where he was, and this seems to be the result of 2 weeks of intense international pressure on the Saudi regime.
Well, allegations flying against the Saudi government, especially from Turkey. What response have we had from members of the Saudi government so far on this?
Well, up until yesterday, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who has basically become the de facto ruler of the country, has been saying that they had no, involvement whatsoever in the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi. Jamal Khashoggi had been a critic of bin Salman. He had written articles in the Washington Post questioning whether bin Salman was gradually becoming a tyrant. Many critics said that the Crown Prince had launched the most fierce crackdown on dissent of any Saudi ruler ever. And then what happened was Khashoggi went into the consulate in Istanbul on October 2nd and never came out. It was for the simplest of reasons. He wanted to get some official papers to get married. And since then, all we've heard from the Saudis is they had no idea what happened to him. But again, that changed yesterday when suddenly reports came out that the Saudis were prepared to admit that he had died during an interrogation at the consulate.
Well, to be clear, Khashoggi is not a U.S. citizen, and his disappearance occurred far from American soil. So just why has this case become such a political hot potato for the United States?
Well, I think partly it's because even though he's not a citizen, he is a permanent resident of the United States. He has written for the Washington Post, and is a journalist. And even Donald Trump, the president, said the other day, and of course Trump has been very critical of the media, that this is outrageous, that that something like this should happen to a reporter, that a reporter or a journalist should be killed for publishing his opinions. So this has created widespread international outrage, and a major conference that Mohammed bin Salman was hosting next week has seen a lot of high-profile figures pull out of it, including many Wall Street banks, major media organizations that were sponsoring it. So this has become a huge embarrassment for the Crown Prince.
Excuse me. Let's talk about the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. How close are our diplomatic and economic ties?
Well, it's always been a relationship of, mutual dependency. The Saudis get U.S. defense protection. We get oil. The Trump administration has deepened that relationship by lining up the Saudis with Israel against Iran. And, of course, President Trump has taken a very hard line stance against Iran, having pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. So there's a great deal of mutual need there, and I think the relationship does survive this. But it has become really impossible in the face of these outrageous allegations of murder, and for the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia to continue normal relations. And so that's why I think we're seeing now the Saudis realizing their back was up against the wall on this. Are now trying to find an off-ramp, if you will, trying a way out of the crisis by admitting that they were interrogating Khashoggi but did not intend to kill him.
Michael Hirsch is a senior correspondent at Foreign Policy and is joining us to talk about the situation with Jamal Khashoggi, who apparently now we think died in a Saudi interrogation room in Istanbul. During a televised interview with Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes on Sunday night, President Trump was asked if he'd commit to sanctions or cutting sales of military equipment to Saudi Arabia from American companies if Saudi Arabia was found to be guilty here. And I think we have a bit of that exchange. Let's play that.
So would you cut that off?
I tell you what I don't want to do. Boeing, Lockheed, Raytheon, all these I don't want to hurt jobs. I don't want to lose an order like that. And you know, there are other ways of punishing.
So, Michael, do you have a sense of what the president is talking about here in terms of what that punishment could entail?
Well, he has not made clear what his response would be, other than to say he doesn't want to eliminate that arms deal, although the $110 billion arms deal that he often refers to is not really all that it's cracked up to be. Many of the contracts haven't been signed yet. But nonetheless, it is a lucrative relationship. It was negotiated, that deal was, by Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. So the president is obviously not willing to throw that overboard. But meanwhile, Congress, and this is a bipartisan effort, is pushing Trump to invoke the Magnitsky Act, under which the U.S. can sanction human rights violators. And in this case, it would be Mohammed bin Salman and his top officials in the Khashoggi case. So I think we're going to see a bit of a struggle here between the White House and Donald Trump, who is reluctant to sanction the Saudis, and Congress and people on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, who want to do so.
Well, and the president has asked Saudi Arabia to increase its oil production to help bring down the price of oil. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia has hinted that any action taken by the U.S. against the country would be met with a greater action, which some are interpreting to mean a surge in oil prices, which economically would not be good for the United States. Do you think that's the implication here?
Well, you know, that is the one piece of leverage the Saudis have always had as the leaders of OPEC. I think that that's probably why there is going to be this negotiated solution whereby the Saudis will admit some guilt that surge in oil prices will not happen. I mean, the Saudis don't really want to do that either, believe me.
On Monday, the president announced he was sending Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and in fact he has gone, to meet with Saudi King Salman and investigate what may have happened. How much international pressure is there on America to get to the bottom of this?
A great deal. I mean, also yesterday, Britain, France, and Germany came out with a statement condemning Mohammed bin Salman. So essentially, the Saudis have been entirely isolated, and Trump finds himself somewhat isolated on this issue, which is why I think that as the days went by, initially last week, Trump was sort of echoing the Saudi line, saying, well, we don't know what happened to him. By the time of his 60 Minutes interview on Sunday, he was saying that there would be, quote unquote, severe punishment if it turned out to be true that Khashoggi was deliberately murdered. So I think that both Trump and the Saudis are now looking for a way out of this situation. And I would be surprised if Trump did not sign on to the Saudi, quote-unquote, confession that's about to come out, where they say they didn't intend to kill him, but he died during interrogation. I think you'll probably see President Trump back up that that line of explanation.
We got about 30 seconds here, Michael. Regardless of what happens, is this going to make us take a closer look at how the United States does business with Saudi Arabia?
One would hope so. Mohammed bin Salman had billed himself as the great reformer. He had charmed not only Donald Trump, but many people in the Western media, American media. And it turns out that that was just, the pleasant face of a very, very severe regime, which is cracking down on dissenters right and left, is not really reforming socially in any way at all. So I hope that that is one result.
Okay. Michael Hirsch, senior correspondent at Foreign Policy. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm John Munson. This program is being broadcast on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.